Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Good morning, Billy Joe. I am so excited. Today we have Professor of Law Lou Verrilli from Stetson University College of Law. He's going to be talking to us today about judicial recusal and his latest book titled Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal and the Constitution.
Linda, this should be a really interesting conversation. It seems like every time I hear a news account, I'm thinking the person should recuse themselves. And I bet he's going to tell us why that can't happen and really isn't the right answer.
My understanding is he thinks the current statute is unconstitutional, but he offers an alternative. So I'm excited to hear about what that might be. Okay, great. Well, good morning, Lou, or afternoon, I guess it is for you guys. Morning for me. We're so excited to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us on Talking Legal Ed. As we get started, I wanted to ask if you could briefly describe your background, what you teach, and how you got interested in judicial recusal in specific.
Sure. So I'm a professor at Stetson in Gulfport, Florida. I've been teaching here for 15 years. I teach constitutional law, administrative law, and civil procedure. I came to Stetson from the Justice Department. I was there for 5 years in the honors program. So I've been engaged in public law and the study of public law basically my entire professional career. And I came to recusal sort of by accident, which I guess is where all good things often happen. I was in the back of the room at a AALS panel about government and judicial ethics. And I just was sitting there listening to very sort of knowledgeable and expert people about the rules of ethics talk about rules governing the Supreme Court and the way they must remove themselves from cases or do not have to remove themselves from cases, recuse themselves. And I was in the back of the room going, why is any of this constitutional? Why does Congress get to tell a Supreme Court justice that they can't participate in a case? Or do they? I hadn't concluded that it was unconstitutional yet. I since have. But at the time, I just found myself thinking about it. And I went back to my office and I assumed I was wrong because I'd only been in the academy for a couple of years. So, with great trepidation, I went forth and I ultimately convinced myself. I don't know if I've convinced anybody else, but I convinced myself enough that I've been writing about it for a little over a decade now.
So when you talk about finding judicial recusal unconstitutional, you're talking about the 1948 Act that Congress passed. Is that the one you're talking about?
That's right. Well, so that act, it's 28 U.S.C. 455. It's the federal judicial recusal statute. It applies to all federal judges. It is actually an artifact of statutes that began in 1792. So there's been a federal judicial recusal statute on the books almost as long as there's been a federal judiciary. 1948, though, you're right, Linda, is the important moment for the Supreme Court because that's the year they added the word justices. So they made the statute mandatory for justices of the Supreme Court at that point, and they never had before. And it had been understood that the statute did not apply to the Supreme Court before that. So that was sort of the turning point.
So in your book, Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal and the Constitution, is this where you decided that the 1948 Act as applied to the justices was unconstitutional?
That's where I took on sort of the big project to really nail down the idea. I wrote an article in 2011 making that claim about the federal judicial recusal statutes. But then in the book, I started to think more about the history of recusal, about how various remedies, right? So how we can still constrain justices ethically without relying on a congressional statute that, interestingly, they summarily ignore and have ignored since the founding of the Republic anyway. And then I started talking about sort of why this is not a similar problem for state courts. But I came to the conclusion that there is a constitutional element for this. For state Supreme Courts and for lower federal courts. I came to the conclusion that there is sort of a constitutional hook for lower federal courts, too. And it's the ability to sit by designation. So I'm assuming the next question is, what's the idea? And I'm happy to do that. I don't want to take the question asking away from anybody.
I guess I'd like to intervene and like, what's your basis for the unconstitutional
theory? Right. No, I mean, that's the question. That's the question that I was sure that I was wrong about at first. And I know I talked myself into it. So Congress has a mandatory legal command, right? A mandate to justices that they must recuse themselves in certain circumstances outlined by Section 455. There is a corresponding sort of constitutional requirement that there be one Supreme Court, right? So the only federal court that's mandated by Article 3 is the Supreme Court. And there's the idiosyncrasy at the Supreme Court that justices are not replaceable when they're recused. So all lower court judges are replaceable. Now, they're replaceable because there's a statute that says they can be replaced, but they are replaceable. And we've come to the conclusion, and this is, you know, there's been some scholarship about this, but I think the overwhelming consensus is still, Billy Joe, to your point, that Supreme Court justices cannot be replaced by another judge to fill their seat when they recuse themselves. So what you do when you recuse a Supreme Court justice is you change the number of people on the court for that case. If you carry that to its logical extension, and this is where people start to roll their eyes at me, but I think the history plays out a little bit differently. If you carry that out to its logical conclusion, you could easily recuse four justices from one case, therefore lack a quorum, and therefore not have a court that's able to exercise authority over a case that it otherwise has jurisdiction over, right? So a simpler way to say that is the congressional recusal statute threatens the availability of the Supreme Court to decide cases over which it otherwise has jurisdiction. And I think that's an unconstitutional infringement on the court's judicial power to decide cases. So in the analysis, I spend a lot of time talking about what judicial power in Article 3 means. And I'm proud to say I took the narrowest definition and I relied on other people for the conclusion that judicial power means at least, and this is where there's real consensus, judicial power in Article 3 means at least the power to resolve disputes, to resolve cases. And if you take the court's ability to do that statutorily, you've infringed on their constitutional authority and therefore violated the Constitution.
So Lou, this is interesting to me because I'm terribly naive. And I guess I assumed that judges often recuse themselves purely out of a personal, professional, ethical manner, that they didn't even need a statute or anything passed, that they would just say to themselves, wow, I think I have some conflict here, but do they actually still do that? Do they do it because of the law, or do some really recuse themselves beyond the law, I guess, or with this side, just moral compass?
Right. So I think there are several questions in there that are all related. So the first thing is that I did not write this book in response to what I viewed as an ethical crisis at the court, right? The problem was not that recusal was never happening or regularly not happening in cases where I thought it should. In fact, I didn't do that ethical analysis at all. I still am refraining from being an ethicist, although I'm getting closer and closer over time, right? Justices have been recusing themselves, and in fact, judges have been recusing themselves since Justinian, right? So some of our recusal laws come from Henri de Bracton in 14th century France and Blackstone, right? So those principles are still true. So recusal is very old and is not dependent on a statute. And the justices do use it regularly. But there is a statute in place. And so my first response was, I'm not suggesting there's a crisis that needs to be resolved, except that the existence of the statute creates expectations in the public that are unrealistic with the reality of the unrealistic when compared to the obligations and functioning of the court. Put another way, the justices have never felt legally bound to recuse themselves against their will, or put another way, when they thought it was a bad idea. And they do not feel that way now that there's a statute. I think the biggest problem there is that the existence of the statute therefore creates the perception that justices are acting illegally, when in fact they're doing what they always did. And the constraints were never coming from an act of legislation, nor should they, because of the reasons I gave about that legislation infringing on their judicial power. There are other criteria by which we can measure recusal, and I think those are important, and I think they are unquestionably constitutional, like, for example, the Due Process Clause. But so, one of the fun parts about the book was I discovered, I was hoping this was true, but I wasn't sure when I started writing the book, Chief Justice Marshall, sort of in Marbury v. Madison, right, sits on a case that he absolutely should not have on due process grounds. There was no statute, but he absolutely should not have. I mean, he is deciding a case that is his fault. He was supposed to deliver the commission to Marbury. He didn't. And then he decided the case where Marbury sues to get his commission from Madison. No way there's any version of recusal where that isn't a recusable event, except that it wasn't, and he didn't, and nobody complained. And one argument is it's more important for the court to be led by their chief justice and for something as important as judicial supremacy to be articulated by a full court acting unanimously than it is to worry about whether Chief Justice Marshall is going to have, going to express favoritism towards Marbury. But then in two other cases soon after, he demonstrates again that he's not applying any consistent legal standard. So he does recuse himself in a case that is less of a obvious decision than Marbury was. And then he refuses to recuse in yet a third case that is sort of in between. So he's going back and forth in this litany of three cases. It doesn't matter. The details don't matter too much. The point being, Chief Justice Marshall was reflecting a notion of recusal that was not legal in the sense that it was not repeatable, it was not governed by precedent, and it was not clearly and objectively articulated. It is a policy choice about whether he should participate in a case.
So Lou, if I understand what you're saying the statute is unconstitutional. The justices, at least as applied to the justices view it or ignore it. Maybe they view it as unconstitutional, but they essentially ignore it. Although the challenge has not yet come, it may, and that you would say that there is another avenue that addresses this concern, and that is the due process clause of the Constitution. What is the standard then under the due process clause that would require judges to recuse, judges like Marbury?
Right. So it's probability of actual bias, and that's the standard under the due process clause. And that sounds a little bit like some of the case law interpreting the federal recusal statute, but it has not been applied that way. It's been applied as a pretty high bar. It has been applied. The Supreme Court tends to apply the due process clause in recusal against state court judges and lower federal court judges. It has never applied it to itself, but it unquestionably would have to, in the sense that it is clearly constitutional for the due process clause to constrain judges and justices. So we don't have a separation of powers problem when we're talking about due process.
So let's look at some examples. You've given Marbury versus Madison, where even under the due process clause, that would have been a violation. What about, for example, there was this Justice Scalia and the duck hunting case. You want to talk about that one a little bit? Or Justice Ginsburg's criticisms of Trump, or Rehnquist's decision not to recuse when the court was reviewing a policy he instituted while at DOJ, or even more currently, let's talk about Justice Thomas and his wife's emails. All of these, how do these play out under your standard?
Good. So two of those are particularly interesting. Well, the duck hunting case is interesting in every dimension, right? Because it involves duck hunting. But the duck hunting case and Justice Rehnquist failing to recuse from a case involving a DOJ policy he was part of while working at DOJ are both interesting because the justices chose to explain their decisions not to recuse in writing. There's only three instances of that happening in Supreme Court history. All of them were decisions not to recuse. And what I cite them for in the book, and what I think is interesting, is that none of them involve any kind of meaningful statutory interpretation. So in all of those cases, two of them by Rehnquist, one by Scalia, they are writing an explanation of why they are not recusing themselves while governed by a validly enacted federal statute, and they are not using the statute at all to explain why they're not recusing. They are citing the past practices of justices from before the statute's inception for why they don't have to recuse. Now, Linda, to your point about whether I think they would come out differently under the due process clause, not necessarily, and this is why, right? So, and I'll get to the sort of the more controversial recent decisions soon also, but the due process calculation, I think, is important for two reasons. One, it's clearly constitutional to apply to the justices. There's no separation of powers problem. And two, it reflects the kind of balancing that I think Supreme Court recusal inherently requires, right? So you are always at the Supreme Court level balancing the fairness to the litigants of a justice participating in the case against the institutional ramifications of changing the number and makeup of the court, right? So you have to decide, are eight justices worth it here? Is it worth deciding a case with only eight out of fairness to the litigants? Or is it better to have nine justices decide this issue because of the ramifications of the decision? I don't think in either the duck hunting case or the DOJ case from the 70s that Rehnquist was involved in, that the balance was necessarily clear. If either of them had recused themselves, I certainly wouldn't have objected, right? I never find myself saying you shouldn't recuse, but I also find myself rarely saying you should, because the balance is delicate and usually overlooked, right? So in Scalia's duck hunting case, I think the reality is having a friend as a named party is rarely a basis for a recusal, especially when that person is named in their official capacity, right? So Vice President Cheney didn't stand to win or lose anything personally. Justice Scalia is a friend. I would wager that, and I know for a fact over history, Supreme Court justices have been very close with lots of presidents and members of their cabinet and their administration. That is has not been a basis for recusal, and often, and there's lots of good reasons why it couldn't be, in part because you would end up not having a court, right, based on personal relationships. The more controversial questions get a lot closer, and I think it looks like Billy Joe has a question, so I don't want to just ramble on, but I will get to those.
This is her second naive question of the day. So do the other justices sometimes believe a justice should be recusing themselves? The fly on the wall in those chambers, are those conversations ever had? Or is it just respect for each person's ethical behavior for that to happen?
Well, and that's a great question. I can't tell you, obviously, and in the most secretive of moments, what justices are saying to each other. But I can tell you, as a publicly facing matter, all of the justices in Senate testimony, in testimony before the House, in their writing, in the 2011 annual report to the federal judiciary, the justices overwhelmingly say, we are not going to tell each other whether to recuse, because, and this is Justice Kennedy talking, he described it as lobbying, as looking like lobbying, because you are changing the composition of the court, right? So imagine the conservative minority lobbying or asking or encouraging a liberal member of a majority to recuse, resulting in a tie vote in an important case, right? Whether they could make that justice recuse is another interesting question. I don't know. That's a much closer call. I don't think it's obvious that they couldn't. It wouldn't be unconstitutional for the justices to adopt their own policy on recusal, for example. They have not, and they won't, but they could. But I think that's the answer is they will refuse to, and they will refuse to for what they describe as principled reasons, because they do not want to be part of making that calculation about who's going to participate in the case. It all goes back to the challenge of losing a justice, when losing numbers when a recusal happens, going from 9 to 8. To 7 to 6, and ultimately, potentially, all the way down to 0.
But I mean, the lobbying comparison, though, I think it's a great comparison.
So, Lou, if I may build on that, let me take you back. So, you said basically the balance is we're trying to decide when it's important for the court to be at full power, a 9-justice court, versus when the interests of the litigants may be stronger, right? So, let's go back to a couple of the examples that we talked about a moment ago. Ginsburg's criticism of Trump, Justice Thomas and his wife's involvement, perhaps, in the January 6th committee. How about Justice Jackson's decision to recuse on the Harvard case? Where do you think those come out?
Good. So the first one is Justice Ginsburg, and this was pretty well publicized at the time, but right after Whole Woman's Health was decided in 2015, or after the lower court decision prior to that, Justice Ginsburg doing a public talk and was asked about the case. And she commented negatively about the Fifth Circuit decision while it was on its way to the Supreme Court. And she did that publicly. And that's problematic because she's talking about the outcome of a particular case that is going to appear before her. That is a common grounds for recusal. I took the position at the time that that is true. And for a lower court judge, I think it would be an easy answer. You must recuse because you can be replaced, right? You are not essential. But in a case challenging or drawing into question the right to terminate a pregnancy, right, one of the most controversial things we decide under our Constitution, there is a serious institutional concern about having a tie vote or losing a knowledgeable, experienced justice's view in the deliberations among her colleagues to resolve this national issue. I did not say that Justice Ginsburg should not recuse herself. But I think the what was lost in that conversation was the institutional question. Do we want to run the risk of a tie vote? So now the Fifth Circuit is deciding that case, right? For the time being. Or do we want to run the risk of the perception of partiality now that Justice Ginsburg has said something out loud? We just have to weigh those things against each other. And by we, I mean the justice, and really only the justice. And we can judge them on that. But when that balance rises to the level of a probability of actual bias, right, under the Due Process Clause, then I think recusal is necessary. What was the other hypo after Justice Ginsburg?
Criticizing Trump. We also have Justice Thomas and Ginny Thomas, and then Justice Jackson, although I think that's probably under your standard does not rise to that level, right, of recusal.
That's right. And she's a great example of sort of how we solve this problem all the time. She voluntarily recused herself, or she agreed in advance to recuse herself during her confirmation hearings. But
let's talk about the Justice Thomas one, if we could. The Justice Thomas one, because I think that a lot of our listeners are going to be really interested in that, because there's just sort of this feeling that he absolutely should recuse. Is that right?
The question is from what, right? So the problem is this conversation is happening before a case has come to the court that would really implicate Ginny Thomas's comments. I think it's without question true that if a case involving the election of 2020 or January 6th came to the court in which any of Ginny Thomas's communications would be evidence, or she might be a witness, or her conduct were in any way relevant to the outcome of the case, then he absolutely has to recuse himself under the Due Process Clause, and failure to do so would be unconstitutional. The case that everybody is talking about is the subpoena, right? The House Committee's subpoena of White House documents relating to January 6th. And all of the reporting I read, and I could not be completely informed about this, but all of the reporting I've read has indicated that nothing that Ginny Thomas said or did was part of that case. So then the question is, does the fact that Justice Thomas's wife have a vested interest in the outcome of a case mean he shouldn't participate? And of course, in a case like January 6th and the outrageous claims being made by Ginny Thomas and others around that event and the damage that event did to the Republic, make it seem like an easier call. Justice Thomas cannot participate. But when we're talking about attributing the actions of a spouse to a justice, we have to be more careful. The reality of it is, historically, we have very little experience with Supreme Court justices' spouses being public figures, right? For reasons that are reflective of the lack of gender equality over the history of the Republic, right? We've had almost exclusively male Supreme Court justices historically, and their wives were not public figures. That is changing now. And what do we do about it? I think the easy case is if Ginny Thomas's materials or her conduct were in any way part of the actual record of the case, that's easy. I think if she spoke with him about it, ex parte contacts are problematic, but very hard to prove. But I think that should be grounds for recusal. But simply involving something that she cares very deeply about is much harder. For example, the Affordable Care Act case. Ginny Thomas made $750,000 lobbying against the ACA, and Justice Thomas did not recuse himself. And my argument at the time was, he's got to do that balance. And this is independent of whether I think a particular justice balanced it correctly, just conceptually. He's got to balance the importance of the largest piece of healthcare legislation in my lifetime being adjudicated against the perception that he is going to be biased against the statute's constitutionality because his wife was politically opposed to it. That is true. But I also don't think anybody was surprised that Justice Thomas came out the way he did, whether his wife was working as a lobbyist or not. I'm not trivializing the issue, but I think we have to be careful how quickly we're going to do that, especially when we start to look across the aisle from wherever we sit, right? So Justice Kagan was also asked to recuse herself in the ACA case on the grounds that she was Solicitor General when the strategy for defending it was being developed. Now, she put up a wall in the Justice Department, but that wasn't litigated, right? We took her word for that. I have no reason not to believe her. But would being Solicitor General alone be enough? I don't know. I think not. And she felt the same way. She did not recuse herself, especially when the alternative is a potential tie vote about the constitutionality of the largest piece of healthcare legislation in the last 50 years. So that balance never goes away. And I think we need to be careful about it. And I think the justices always have been doing it, even if they don't do it out loud. And I think generally they've been careful about it. The Ginsburg-Trump one, I think, is the best example of what I mean. She was very critical of candidate Trump. Justice Ginsburg was very critical of candidate Trump before the election. And so people like me got lots of questions. What happens if there's a lawsuit over the election, if we have Trump v. Clinton instead of Bush v. Gore? Does Justice Ginsburg have to recuse? And I said no, because you can't have the presidency resolved by an 8-member court, because you can't have it resolved by a circuit court if they tie. You just can't. Now, that's not necessarily true in all situations. I guess it's possible Justice Ginsburg could do or say something, or some other justice, that would make me feel differently about the balance. But that balance, I think, is pretty clear because the stakes institutionally are so high, almost regardless of what the perception of bias might be. Not impossible to flip that balance, but if we're not thinking about the balance, then we don't understand the case appropriately. And that's really the theme of all of my work.
Well, that would also explain when we did have Bush v. Gore and Justice O'Connor did not recuse, although many felt that she should have. Let me turn it over to Billie Jo. I think she has a question she wants to ask here.
Well, Lou, I wondered, with the Ginni Thomas obvious lobbying and major contributions, would you feel differently if a justice, and maybe they're not permitted to by law, but that I'm not aware of, but what if one of the justices contributed a major contribution to a campaign or the ACA or some issue that might become before them?
I would feel very differently. And I can give an actual concrete example. I was recently asked last summer, there was reporting done that, and multiple justices were attending prayer meetings of an organization that filed an amicus brief in Dobbs. Now, I never was able to sort out the timing about whether they attended prayer meetings with this organization while that amicus brief was pending in the case. But in my view, that is very close to a bridge too far. That is likely a bridge too far to me. You should not be fraternizing with an organization that has taken an interest in the case on the record, whose brief you have invited and are reading. Right? It doesn't mean that I think it's going to change the outcome, that what goes on at that prayer meeting is going to move a vote. But I think as a matter of sort of institutional integrity, you should not be going to any kind of meeting that gives access to a Supreme Court justice of a group that has a noted and public role in a case, even if it's just as an amicus. Doesn't mean you can't pray with this group ever, but not while they're an amicus in the case. And I think that is too far. And I think we are getting to a point now, what seems to be indicating job security for me, at least in this area, and is becoming sort of more interesting, is that the justices are out and about way more than before. Right, they're spending more time talking to groups that will take positions in their cases. They are speaking publicly more often about their views. And we are just generally as a society on the record more often now. So I think that's going to create new questions. And I think I will likely find myself more often saying, should have recused, than I have in the past. But I want to be clear, I don't think I'm the authority on that. If I'm an authority on anything, it's the process. And it's sort of drawing attention to the fact that it's too simplistic to say a reasonable person would find that this justice appears unable to be impartial. There's lots of negatives in that. That's how the statute's written, right? That's not enough when you're talking about changing the composition of the court. And in case, and I didn't say this earlier, Linda, but I think it's important. In case our listeners are going, he's just Chicken Little, right? They're never going to recuse so many of them that they can't decide a case. Well, there's an example from the 1940s where so many justices recused from a securities case that they lost a quorum, and the Chief Justice just unrecused himself. No change in facts, no explanation, just unrecused himself in order to maintain a quorum. Now, we can decide whether or not we think that's ethically sound, but the alternative was not resolving the case over which there was jurisdiction and which cert was granted on. That's a perfect example of the justices always considering their institutional obligations when they make these decisions. And I think it's important that we publicly acknowledge them. Otherwise, we can't understand what's happening. And we certainly shouldn't be hanging our hat on a federal statute that I think is unconstitutional, but either way is not working, right? Is not being applied by the justices in anything like any other legal mandate.
So I could imagine if we had another Bush v. Gore and whatever the next election might be, that if all of the, if the view is all of the people from the opposing or from the same party need to recuse, we wouldn't have a quorum. I mean, you could see, you know, if a conservative is elected, all the conservatives have to recuse. Well, we'd have a three-member bench. Yeah, I could see it happening. Well, on Talking Legal Ed, we like to move this into the classroom. And you mentioned earlier that you teach con law and administrative law. So how do you bring your research, or do you, to your students?
I do. I mean, I always do. And I warn them in advance, because I get decidedly more animated when I'm talking about this. But I want to convince them that I'm still open to other ideas, even if it may not always be true. But in con law, I think it best fits when I talk about the legitimacy of the court. So I think it's a really important point, at least from my perspective, to make to first years, that what Justice O'Connor said in Casey, right, that the court's power lies in its ability to persuade. It really is not an inherently powerful institution in a coercive way, right? Neither, you know, force nor will, but merely judgment, to quote Hamilton. So the fact that the court has no funds to rely on itself, Congress has all the money, they have no guns, those all rely on the executive, they have only pen and paper, means they have to guard their reputation to continue to earn or otherwise gain the acceptance of the public that they are judging. And recusal is a big part of that. So not only is it important that we have objective, neutral decision makers to resolve cases, of course it is, but when we're talking about the Supreme Court, very rarely are we, as a collective, as a 360 million person country, worried about the parties at that point. Of course, the case matters to them, but the court's almost always doing something much bigger. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken the case. Their integrity depends in part on their ability to employ recusal in a way that makes sense and that we can understand, and that gives us confidence that the right people are participating in the right cases at the right time. And I make a big deal of that to my students from the time we read Marbury on. I point out that Chief Justice Marshall should have recused himself under every measure except the realistic one, which says, if you're going to claim judicial supremacy for a branch of government that prior to that was far less powerful, and in fact had just been closed by Jefferson's administration for 2 years, totally unconstitutionally, right, from 1801 to 1803, the court is closed by Congress. If that's the platform you're operating from and you're Chief Justice Marshall trying to make an argument for judicial supremacy, you cannot recuse yourself from that case. You cannot achieve your institutional objective by doing that. So is he right? I don't know. But is it important to understand the context and the institutional realities? Absolutely. And I make a big deal about that all the way through, because I think there's lots of decisions that the court makes that implicate its legitimacy. I talk about it in Brown. I talk about it in Loving. I talk about it in Korematsu, not always defending the court, of course, right? But talking about how its legitimacy hangs in the balance and that recusal is a part of that. In administrative law, it's a great way to try to get at a very difficult concept, for my students at least, I think for most, which is what infringements on power look like, right? So all of our students come with sort of the Schoolhouse Rocks idea of separation of powers. Branches do things separately. They are able to understand overlap and checks and balances. But it's often very difficult when I teach CFTC v. Shore and the administrative adjudication cases, how to get them to understand that creating an administrative tribunal to resolve a dispute takes something meaningful from federal courts. And I'm not suggesting it does so unconstitutionally, that's a bigger question, but that is an infringement on some notion of judicial power. And to get them to see that can be really hard, right? Because from their perspective, you're not stopping the court from doing anything. You're just creating another way. So the recusal statute, I think, is a really good way for me to show that relationship and how it can be problematic when I tell them that if a former clerk or a personal friend of four of the justices appears before them as a lawyer, do they have to recuse themselves? Well, under the statute, maybe. That looks like a reasonable appearance of partial, right? A reasonable person might think they could not be impartial if they have a close friend as an advocate on one side. And by the way, totally realistic that a court like ours has the same friends, right? Operates in the same professional and social circles. Should they all recuse themselves and deprive the court of a quorum? Maybe not. But should Congress make them? No. Or more to the point, is Congress forcing them to recuse themselves doing something to the court? Is it having a consequence for their judicial power? Absolutely. And when they understand that, then that gives them a much better handle on sort of the separation of separation of powers concepts in administrative law.
Yeah, sure, is a tough one to teach. There's no doubt about that. I'm curious whether you have had lawyers reach out to you in cases pending before the Supreme Court to use your due process clause approach, although generally it seems like it's going to be rare that someone would need to actually recuse. So maybe they don't like, maybe litigants don't like your analysis. But have you had that happen at all? Any practicing attorneys reaching out to you about this particular issue?
No, and certainly not at the Supreme Court level, because if they know where I'm coming from, they're going to want to use the statute. The statute is worded more broadly than the due process standard, so it's a better vehicle for recusal. So I am generally not the recusing party's friend. And to be clear, I did not set out to do that. And I have never once said a justice should not recuse themselves. Right? I think there's always a benefit, may not be a net benefit, but there always is some beneficial outcome to a justice showing enough humility to say, I don't think my participating in this case is a good look. Right? I think that's always coming from at least a laudable place. So that's not never my position. But no, I don't get that. I get a lot of reporters trying to figure out claims of, you know, sort of public uprisings about local judges and state Supreme Court judges. And of course, when the Ginni Thomas controversy happens, or the Justice Jackson controversy over affirmative action happens, I get a lot of questions from the press about that. Sometimes judges will contact me wanting to know sort of what I think. And oftentimes, if they're familiar with my work in advance, they will be open to the idea, right, that it is more of a flexible standard, certainly if they're a court of last resort, which is where most of this work is being done.
But just to be clear, you don't have a problem with the federal statute applying to the lower district courts and the appellate courts. It's simply the Supreme Court because of its unique position in our constitutional structure.
That's right. I do not have a problem with it, but I actually think it's constitutionally required. So I think if the statute were repealed, sitting by designation would be required by Article 3 for exactly the reason that you just gave, is that the lower courts could have exactly the same problem as the Supreme Court, simply for practical reasons. There are some districts with fewer judges, district court judges in them, than there are justices of the Supreme Court. So it is possible for the federal recusal statute to deprive a litigant in a jurisdiction of a jurist to decide their case, if not, but for sitting by designation. So one of the chapters of the book is, by the way, lower courts are exempt from this, except I think that sitting by designation is constitutionally required in order to make sure that jurisdiction can be fruitful, can be brought to bear in a given dispute. Because I think that's a due process question, right? If I have jurisdiction in a place and I file a lawsuit and you tell me there's no judge to hear it, I have to go somewhere else, I think that's a due process problem. So I really, the upshot is, if they repealed the statute that allows for sitting by designation, I would think it would still be allowed and in fact required if there was no other option, if it was a necessity issue in a given jurisdiction.
And we don't have sitting by designation at the Supreme Court level, correct?
We do not. And that's a little more controversial because, you know, there's been proposals about the Supreme Court sitting in panels or retired justices being available to fill seats. And that really comes down to a pretty simple explanation, but a more complicated question, which is, what does one Supreme Court mean? The overwhelmingly common wisdom is that one Supreme Court means a single body made up of a finite number of justices that cannot be added to or subtracted from institutionally, right? So you couldn't have a retired justice who only sits when there's a vacancy by recusal. That would not be one court. Now, people can disagree about that, but that's how the understanding historically has been, and that's how most of the scholarship has gone. I think sitting by panels clearly is not one court, unless you forbid en banc review. But if you forbid en banc review of a Supreme Court panel, you create a whole nother set of problems that I don't think people would like, right? So if you have en banc review, then you just add another level of appellate review that's done by a subset of the Supreme Court, and your court of last resort is still the en banc Supreme Court. So I think the only permutation that could work would be retired justices sitting by designation effectively. But I am persuaded by the overwhelming sort of historical understanding that that's not consistent with the one Supreme Court idea, because that's not a final tribunal. There's too many variables there.
So Lou, is there a next book?
Well, it's funny you say that. I'm designing my sabbatical project. My sabbatical application is not due for another 4 hours, but it's due.
Okay.
But I don't know that there's another book, but I think my next project here is going to be looking more carefully and historically at the legislation involving the court and recusal, and not just the ones that were passed, because I'm pretty familiar with all of those, but the ones that were proposed. So I think I've counted 40 proposed bills since 2011 that involve recusal at the court or a Supreme Court code of ethics, one or the other. None of them passed, but they were all introduced and they keep coming. And I still think they're all unconstitutional, but I want to understand that process better and see if I can learn anything about where Congress is coming from to maybe think of other remedies that I think would work constitutionally and that I can advocate for that way.
Well, Lou, thank you so much. This has been so educational. And I think maybe took a direction that our audience might be surprised about. I don't know that you're making a whole lot of friends out there, but I appreciate your time today. It's been lovely talking with you.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for listening. We look forward to speaking with you again in our next episode of Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.